Okay, here we are again, Sunday with Tamsin and Dan, right? It's still January 22nd, and we have a special guest today, Sadie Abuhoff, daughter of Tamsin and Dan.
All right, say hello, Sadie.
Hi.
Okay, so now I have all three of us, and we are... commenting, of course, on today's New York Times, where the big story is about the protests throughout the country with respect to women's gatherings.
And I don't know if they're protests. Weren't they more like demonstrations?
Well, whatever they are, but we are not covering them.
Because this is the big inauguration weekend, right? We just had the inauguration of President Trump.
Not covering them. We're not covering that. We're not discussing that. We're going...
It's not in a negative way.
Not in a negative way. But
you make it sound like we're not interested in that.
No,
it's an interesting topic.
It is interesting.
We're just not addressing it in this forum.
And we all know many people who are involved in it, right? All over the country.
We're spending a lot of time on something that we're not talking about.
That's funny. It's funny that the man in the room is suddenly not interested in such a topic.
Sadie, let me just ask you this. Do you know anything about the pink hats? Did everybody make their own hats?
I think it was a combination.
Okay, were there like things posted, here's how to? Was the design created? Do you know anything about it? Because it looks like a really easy thing to do.
I mean, so, I think the purpose of the design was... I've heard two interpretations. One is that it's supposed to be reminiscent of a cat. So it's like cat ears, in the sense that they use the term pussy a lot. And then the other interpretation is that it's the shape of a uterus.
Oh, very nice. Yes, but I was more interested in how it happened. The idea of mobilizing all these people to make these things is
I would
impressive.
Imagine that it was part of the preparation paraphernalia, and I'm sure they sold them on site, but I wasn't aware of it beforehand.
Anyway, so speaking of protests and demonstrations, Dan noticed an article in the New York Times today about
the Smothers Brothers.
And so, who are the Smothers Brothers?
Yeah, well,
Sadie, do you even know who the Smothers Brothers are?
No.
Okay. Smothers Brothers were brother entertainment team in the 1960s.
Comedians.
Well, there were singers. They were folk singers / comedians.
Oh, okay.
And they would their standard drill was that they each had guitars and they would start singing some folk song about Joe Hill or whoever, any standard folk song. And then there would be a break, and Tom Smothers, who would play the dumb one, would ask some kind of odd, off-the-wall question. And Dick would try to answer it and say, let's get back to singing. And then they'd go a few more bars and Tom would come up with the same question. I'm not really satisfied with that answer, seeming increasingly dim. And then Dick would be impatient and say, no, it's nothing to worry about, blank, blank, blank. And a few more bars and then Tom one more time would ask the question. Dick would lose his patience and hilarity would ensue.
Hilarity. Did you think they were funny?
They were funny.
I never thought they were funny.
It was kind of a Northeastern urban vibe.
So what's the article about?
The article, so the Smothers Brothers parlayed this act into a television variety show, which was aired opposite Bonanza every Sunday night. I presume that was 8 o'clock or 9, probably 8 o'clock at night. Bonanza being the most popular show on television. CBS striving mightily to come up with something to oppose Bonanza.
Okay.
And they were successful. They were successful. They had a young audience. They outdrew Bonanza every once in a while. But they caused quite a few protests. There were a lot of people who would write in and complain to the network about the content of what they had to say because they veered into political commentary. And when you look at back at them, and this article describes a little bit of what they did, and even Dick, Dick Smothers, who was interviewed for the article, says, I didn't think we sang that well, but now I can see the genuineness, the whimsy that we had, and I think there's something to that. But, I mean, the kind of acts that they had tells you how the country was different then. These folks were branded really protesters and leftists and drew quite a bit of ire from what I'll call, for lack of a better term, Middle America. They talk about a 1967 installment here. The guests are Betty Davis, Mickey Rooney, and The Who. You know, it covers a wide span. It's hardly, you know, firebrands talking about political issues. But the article goes on to describe how increasingly there were protests that caused CBS to drop the show, which is mind-boggling considering how financially successful the show was. And yet they bow to political pressure. And your first reaction is to say, well, that would never happen. Now the country's much more liberal, much more open to different views, although not entirely clear. You wonder if there was something that was politically incorrect, not necessarily for the same kind of political issues that Smothers Brothers were commenting on, but just something that was out of tune with what people thought was acceptable, whether you have the same kind of negative reaction, opposition mail, and whether they'd be dropped like a hot potato. I think the answer is probably they would. So we sort of exercise that in a different way. But in any event, it's just an interesting throwback to protests in the media, Smothers Brothers being a much more gentler approach and something that seems quaint today, but was quite controversial in the 60s.
All right.
Well, okay. Something to chew on. So we go from there to Tamsin and Sadie saw a film this weekend, Hidden Figures.
Yeah, I finally saw the Hidden Figures.
Yes, Dad was working. Dad missed it, but I'll leave it to them to describe it.
Dad didn't want to see it. Oh, you know why? Because it's a math movie. No. Dan is not interested in math.
He's not interested in the fact that women do math.
Yes, math is not for girls.
We're going to come back to this theme a couple times.
Yes, probably. For those who don't realize, Dan was a mathlete in his day.
I think most people understand that. But maybe you can describe the movie before you go running ahead on commenting on it. Not everyone is familiar.
I don't know if we want to describe the movie, but it's... Do you want to describe it, Sadie?
Well, it's basically about a group of African-American women who do the manual... They do the manual computing for NASA, because they didn't have actual computers back then, so they check a lot of the math or do the math themselves for all of the NASA scientists and engineers. And the general plot is that the three main characters have crucial roles in this group, and one of them has a crucial role in John Glenn's launch and landing math. And they basically end up depending on her. And then the other two, one becomes an important engineer for the group. And then one learns how to program the IBM, the new IBM machine, and teaches the rest of the women how to program it so they don't end up out of a job from this new math machine.
And this is all based on real people.
Right.
And they all kind of come up against various difficulties in... You know, getting their jobs, getting their education, maintaining their jobs, etc. And but the truth is, it's a very entertaining movie. It's a feel-good movie, but although you don't feel good the whole time, because it is shocking, a lot of the racism and things that were going on at the time. And
even the sexism. And there's a lot of parts where you can see where there's open racism and sexism. And people have these disgusted looks on their faces or disgusted reactions to things. And it just kind of begs the question, is it really that big of a deal for men and women and blacks and whites to use the same coffee pot or to, you know, sit at a desk across from each other or put their names both on a paper that they both worked on? Yeah. Things like that.
Yeah. Well, it's just hard to imagine at this point, but... Movie was good. Music was great. We'd heard the music was great, and it was.
Yeah, what's odd to me is that the music is credited to Pharrell and to Hans Zimmer. Hans Zimmer being a veteran composer of music scores, and he's got several Oscars to prove it. So I think of him more as a conventional composer, but how do they mix the Pharrell Williams score with the Hans Zimmer score? Was that obvious watching it?
No, I didn't. I can't say I knew that.
Pharrell at least wrote like the main song. Like, you know how for every movie, if there's a main theme that is, whatchamacallit, nominated for an Oscar or something. Mm-hmm. Pharrell wrote that song that was, I know, nominated for a Golden Globe. I don't know if it's nominated for an Oscar. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what involvement he had on the rest of the score.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a very good movie. And we can recommend it, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing we watched with Sadie this weekend was we watched his final episode of The Crown. Mm-hmm. Sadie has already watched all The Crown. She binge-watched it, so this is all review.
Well, we've watched that all of it now also.
Yeah, we've watched it all now. But, I mean, it took us a while to catch up to Sadie. But I just have to say, I did not think it was such a great ending.
No, I thought it was fine.
Oh, I didn't think so.
Well, it's not an ending.
It's not an ending, right.
It's an end of a season.
No, but I don't think it was one of the better episodes. You know? Okay. You know why? Because it spins on this idea of whether she's going to let her sister get married.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff that's always boring to me. Okay? Well, when these controversies that are very meaningful to the aristocracy or to, you know, old-timey people in England or something, but mean nothing to us today. That's such a big deal.
But it's just one of the themes of the whole show is how does she manage her personal life and her family life with being the queen.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And that's something that's weaved throughout all of the episodes.
But I think it's more compelling if it's something you can relate to.
Well, the whole show is about, none of us can relate to being the Queen of England. And the whole show is limited to some degree, although potentially limited by the fact that they're dealing a lot with domestic issues. Because the Queen of England wasn't really on the front lines of really important social issues, on the periphery. And that, as Sadie describes, that's the major tension in the main character's life going forward, is balancing her role as the queen and her personal life. I mean, to me, I thought the pivotal scene was the one in which she gets on the phone with the Duke of Windsor. And one of the interesting things about the show throughout is that she has a relationship with the Duke of Windsor.
That's perfectly interesting. But when he is saying, but you have to, maintain the crown or support the crown.
He says, first of all, just to set it up, she says, I don't know what to do. On the one hand, I feel I made a promise to my sister. On the other hand, I have responsibilities to the country and the church. And he clearly says, yeah, no one understands this better than I do. I was in the same bind and I went with a woman I love. But his advice to her is, that's not the way you ought to go, ultimately. Reading between the lines of what he says to her, so I'm a king without a kingdom. And I think you have the same choice that I had to make, and I think you ought to choose your kingdom. And so she ends up taking a different tact than what the Duke of Windsor took.
The thing is, it's not her reign that's at stake, necessarily. In his case, it was his reign that was at stake, and he made the choice. I mean, he could have pulled a Henry VIII and just made his own rules,
right,
and made a big deal out of it and just changed the way that they operate. And he chose to uphold all the rules that were put in place for the monarchy and leave the country and abdicate the throne. So he kind of did preserve the monarchy by leaving.
Oh, maybe. Maybe. But in any event, she clearly, the choice she makes, is that she puts front and center the country and her responsibilities as queen, and she puts secondary her personal relationships, including those she values with her sister. That's the point.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I just think
that's the tension. That's the major thing she has to resolve.
But it's all based on it's kind of a frivolous distinction. And even she meant, when she's calling the prime minister and saying, can't you guys support this? Since four of you are divorced,
right,
et cetera. And they're like, it just seems like it's, a very elite.
Well, she's the queen of England, Tamsin. It's going to be elite. I mean.
I just don't think it's as interesting or relatable or compelling as if,
it's
her problems with Philip or whatever.
I think it's relatable in the sense that with any situation like that, any institution, you have to figure out where you're going to hold the line and where you're going to modernize. And there she chose to hold the line and not try to innovate or change the rules or go.
Well, that's another issue, yeah.
And I think that's one of her other themes, is that, like, where can she do something new and where does she have to respect the monarchy?
But it was only new for her.
No, not at all.
People were getting divorced. And remarrying everywhere else in the world.
It was new for the church.
Yeah.
It's not about her. It's new for the church. You have the church on the one hand. Yeah. So she's taking a backseat to all this. And she's the one who has to deal with the tension in between the established institutions on the one hand and modern life on the other. And she's just thrown in the middle. And she's trying to navigate it.
You could apply that to any business today.
Yeah.
When, you know, they have to come up with new rules to accommodate new, you know, just trends or ways of life in America. They have to decide if they're going to accommodate new things or if they're just going to hold the line and say no. And it comes in little ways and in big ways. Like, getting dressed in the morning is generally a lot more casual. So you have to decide if your firm is going to change their dress code or if they're going to say, no, actually, we really need to wear suits every day and just be a stick in the mud.
But this only related to her family. Okay, people were getting divorced and remarried.
No, I understand, but this was only a very specific little thing.
It has to do...
But it would have had huge implications.
Yeah, she still...
No one would even notice.
But she's still trying to balance. Look, she's still trying to balance. On the one hand, she's seeing the news reports where the country's behind the young couple. And the country wants to see her sister married to this divorced man. So what she has is popular opinion on the one hand. And she had she's very focused on. And on the other hand, she has the institutions.
It's not clear, you know...
Well, I'm accepting that for the show.
If you took a vote... What everyone would vote about.
Right. I'm just taking what they hand us in the show. What they hand us in the show is popular opinion juxtaposed.
Anyway, it's a good show. If you haven't seen that show.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You should really.
All right. So changing the subject.
Yeah.
There's. I'm drinking turmeric tea at the moment, and Tamsin saw an article in the Times about turmeric tea.
Yeah. Yeah. We drink a lot of turmeric tea. It will cure everything.
Is it turmeric or turmeric?
Turmeric.
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 It's like Verazan.
It's a root, it's an orange root. I make kind of a chai out of it, similar to what's in the New York Times magazine, similar to that recipe, actually. I made it up myself like a year ago, so I'm way ahead of the New York Times, as usual, not surprising. It has some honey and black tea and milk. I use almond/coconut milk, etc. But we're awfully healthy now, aren't we?
Yes, we're phenomenal.
But the person who writes the article in the Times got their recipe, or actually got the idea from their grandmother in Nairobi. So that I thought was interesting.
Now, a lot of people are into turmeric. I like the flavor.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it really does for you, I don't know if it's a placebo or...
I think it cures everything.
Yeah.
I think it cures everything.
Or nothing. Maybe it doesn't.
An immune booster or something.
An immune booster.
Yeah, it's anti-inflammatory.
Oh,
and so
that's
on.
Everything
so is the
cures
cure.
Everything. There's little doubt about that. And
when you go to the supermarket, it's often out. So, you know, people are on.
No, in the Arts and Leisure. Well, I was looking through the Arts and Leisure, and actually Sadie saw this. There's actually an exercise program in the Metropolitan Museum. You can sign up to run around, literally run around the museum with some dancers before it opens. And apparently you do get exercise, but apparently the best part of it is you're in the empty museum, and which I imagine could be really, really fun. I guess I was in the empty Met years ago. I had an internship there. So it is a fun thing to do. It costs $35.
So people are running through the museum?
Yeah.
Well, more like dancing.
Dancing through, running through.
What they age work are the people? Sweat.
I don't know. You'd have to go and see who signs up and who gives the $35.
And what time of day is it?
It's before Mets, like 8 o'clock in the morning or something.
Really?
Yeah.
Sounds like an opportunity for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's the idea.
You know, for a guy who loves museums, not...
is it the equivalent of like going to a mall?
And doesn't run.
Walking in a mall or something like that?
It's just being there, you know. Running around.
They seem to wear compelling outfits, too, the people that lead it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds like a real moneymaker. Anything to raise money for the Met, I guess.
Well, who said the prophets were going to the Met?
Yeah, I don't know.
Who knows?
All right, so speaking of the Met...
Different Met.
But the Met necessarily, instead of the Metropolitan Museum, the Metropolitan Opera. There is an obituary this week of Roberta Peters, who was an opera singer at the Met, and it's a very interesting obituary. It's Friday's paper, and it describes Roberta Peters as a great opera singer and tells her whole story from her fairly humble beginnings, living like on 167th Street or something like that. And how she, as I guess her parents said, she always had a voice. And apparently she came to the attention of people who were in the biz and got encouragement and got lessons and actually quit school at an early age to continue her studies. And ultimately was accepted based on auditions for part at the Met. But even before she was supposed to make her formal first appearance at the Met, someone got sick, and she was drafted at the last minute to appear in an opera that Tams and I recently saw at a movie theater, Don Giovanni. And that was pursuant to a program some of you might be familiar with, which is by which the certain movie theaters show live operas in HD.
Yeah, we're trying to learn about the opera. So we went to one of these broadcasts. It was fun.
Right. And Don Giovanni was interesting. And I know from that, that's the only reason I do know, that the part that Roberta Peters played was, let's call it, a middling part, third or fourth lead or something like that, but not a totally insignificant part. And she did extremely well, and her whole career followed from that. It was a tremendous career. It's kind of interesting because you talk about times change and her role change. She was, as a well-known American opera singer, appeared in the Ed Sullivan Show, according to obituary, some 20, 30 times.
Yeah.
And number one, it's kind of odd that the main variety show in the nation would show opera on a regular basis. It's not what you would do today. It's also a matter of how quickly the country changes, because 20 years later, after that level of popularity and celebrity, she was appearing on American Express ads, Do You Know Me?, sort of jumping out of a cab, and because no one really would know who she was, because she was now on the outside of what I'll call mainstream entertainment. But in any event, it's a noteworthy life and a very interesting life story. And more generally, I mean, I think it's worth noting, the obituaries are pretty interesting. I mean,
Well, her dad was a shoe salesman.
Yeah, and her mother
and
was
her mom was a milliner.
Right.
Hat maker. Her grandpa worked at Grossinger's.
Right.
You see Grossinger's or Grossinger's?
I think you can get away with either now, but it's the latter.
Okay. Grossinger's. And managed to get her in front of Jan Pierce.
You should say, Grossinger's one of those upstate Borscht Belt hotels.
Yeah.
Where people like Danny Kaye worked and something like that and were discovered. But yeah, I mean, it's a great story. Again, came from humble beginnings. The idea of an American opera singer was a foreign thing, and perhaps still is somewhat foreign thing, perhaps not as much, though. But just going back to obituaries generally, I mean, that's a great obituary story to read, a story of a great life. But it really gives you a window into not only the person's life, but the country over the last 50, 60, 70, 80 years. These are older people who are passing away. And they're a couple connections that you see.
Okay, but let's go back to Roberta.
Okay.
All right. Because, first of all, there's some other interesting things about her. So once she gets, once she gets the sort of, what would you call it? Imprimatur, the...
Impresarial, what?
The
approval?
I guess approval of Jan Pierce. And he connects her with a singing teacher. I mean, she drops out of school after junior high.
Right.
And she's full-time working on this career.
Oh, yeah.
Including physical training.
Right.
Which includes working out with the original Pilates.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Pilates.
Right.
Who would do things like...
Joseph Pilates. Right.
Stand on her stomach.
Right.
Stand on her stomach. Because she's trying to develop, the abdominal...
Right.
Strength and the strength of the diaphragm and everything like that. I mean, that just boggles the mind.
Well, what boggles the mind, quite apart from what it means for something to stand on your stomach, because I don't have much of a sense of that. But A lot of times when you're looking at obituaries, you get the feeling that they're all, you know, years ago, there were only like 25 people. And they all kind of knew each other. So when people get exercise
that
instruction.
That is funny, yeah.
It is from Joseph Pilates.
Jan Pierce, right. Roberta Peters, when they get, Joe Pilates. You know,
they get their makeup done, it's by Max Factor.
Right.
You know, and that happens all the time. The world was just a much smaller thing, or just there was a smaller community of influential people. And the CO you connect those dots is always startling. And again, you see that in the obituaries. But just to go back to the obituaries for a second, as I was saying, the connecting with the crown, Lord Snowden passed away this week. And Lord Snowden is the man who actually married the princess that we're writing about in the crown. It wasn't the commoner that they're talking about. I don't know if that's a spoiler alert, because that actually is history and everybody knows.
I was alive during the time.
I heard of this. It might
okay.
be. Well, it's kind of startling because...
Why is it startling? It's
because he was really near the well. I mean, he was... The guy who she ended up being prevented from marrying was really a model of propriety compared to Lord Snowden. And that's what the monarchy forced the princess into, a marriage that I'm sure they came later came to regret in a serious way, and I think that ended in divorce.
Yeah,
the other notable obituary this week was Mel Ferrer. Did you see that?
Yeah.
And
who played a guy named Granger?
Granger
on the show that you hate, the L.A. NCIS. LA.
Well, quite apart from the name Granger, but
you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's my name. That's my son's name.
Right, but quite apart from that,
I was sad that he died.
Yes, but what's interesting is who his parents were.
I don't even know.
Last name.
They called him Granger.
Yes, but did you notice who his parents were?
Yes, Jose Ferrer.
Right.
And...
We knew it was Jose Ferrer, the great Jose Ferrer,
who went to Princeton.
And was famously Cyrano in many other parts. In the movies, was a huge figure in the 40s and 50s in the film and in the theater.
Oh, and his mother was related to George Clooney?
His mother is Rosemary Clooney.
His mother is Rosemary
was
Clooney?
Was Rosemary Clooney.
You're kidding.
Yes, I knew I would get you on that.
I forgot that.
His mother was Rosemary Clooney. And, of course, that would make him a cousin of George Clooney.
You know, we've already noted two people who are in White Christmas today, I'm just saying.
Really? Who's
There's
that?
Kind of a White Christmas.
Rosemary Clooney and who? And then Danny Kaye?
Yes.
Ah, I'm glad you're keeping score. We'll probably get all four before we're done.
Which brings to mind 6 degrees of separation.
Right. Well, it's the same thing that only being 25 people. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
And who was in the original of that?
Stockard Channing.
And when did we last see Stockard Channing?
When we saw Hamilton.
We had brunch with her.
It's almost as if I'm awake.
At a production of Hamilton at the Public.
All right, it's 4 degrees of separation.
I mean, this is name-dropping central here today.
But you would, you know, you'd be inclined to say that Mel Ferrer was not musical like the rest of the Clooney family, but for two reasons. One is that George Clooney's not musical, and two is that Mel Ferrer was a drummer. So there you have it.
So you're saying he's George Clooney's cousin?
Yeah.
And George Clooney would be the least musical member of the...
And they're friendly.
Clooney family.
They were friendly.
Is that right?
He was in the. What was the movie he was in where he had to sing? Where they were like a folk singing band.
Yes, Brother or Art Thou.
Yeah.
That's right. And they dubbed in his voice. They didn't let him sing. It's proof positive.
So speaking of entertainment and revivals, Sunday in the Park with George is being done for a few minutes, 10 weeks. Starting in February with Jake Gyllenhaal.
I know Jake Gyllenhaal was saying that was one of his favorite plays or musicals.
That's sort of hard to believe.
It is hard to believe, but he's hard to believe.
Well, the whole thing's hard to believe. And first of all, I should say, the reviews, they did it for a weekend set of performances a couple of months ago, and the reviews were ecstatic, particularly for Jake Gyllenhaal. And none of us in this room... Think of Jake Gyllenhaal as a singer, but he apparently was outstanding.
Well, right. he did a little bit of karaoke at the last Tony Awards, and he got good feedback for it. So.
Is that right?
He sang,
so is that how this happened?
He sang A Whole New World with Sean Hayes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two I wanted to see.
Come on, what do you have against Sean Hayes?
Nothing. There's nothing.
Cindy and I have seen him on Broadway.
But Sean Hayes is musical. You know that. I mean, he won a musical. He's a classical musical scholarship, I think, at college. I think he was supposed to be a classical musical performer. And he bounced into this.
Did you notice who's directing
No, who's the director?
Sarna Lapine.
James Lapine's son? Daughter?
Niece.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Keeping it in the family.
And we Annalie, we saw Annalie Ashford in something, too. She's quite good.
We saw something in the Perfect George, what, like 10 years ago?
Was it that long ago?
It could have been.
Okay.
I guess.
It's not my favorite.
Not my favorite.
Well, it's interesting.
But I mean, also, this production could be a better production.
That's what
I've
heard.
You can see things, and it's not...
Look, it was a great review at the time.
Sondheim is a little...
Oh, here we go. Take it easy.
Watch what you say.
Take it easy there.
Watch what you say.
Yeah.
He's a little non-traditional.
Okay, fine. Look, it's not the most accessible thing. It's not the most action-packed musical.
It's not like a straightforward rom-com.
It's not Oklahoma.
That's what I look for in any...
That's right.
Musical, movie, whatever. Right, I just want a rom-com.
But you saw Company. You liked Company, didn't you?
Yes, but that also was a lot...
It was
a different thing. All the production we saw, everyone was playing an instrument. And it was very minimalistic in terms of any set or anything.
But also...
But it had really relevant themes that were driven very,
exactly.
very strongly. I feel like Sunday in the Park with George is not...
You're
as
right.
theme-centric.
Yeah, well, it's different themes. You know, the Company was quite sharp and sardonic. It was about urban life and dating and relationships. And you contrast that with Sunday in the Park with George, which was about the creation of art, which is sort of much more amorphous, much more high-toned, harder to put your arms around, really. And it's one of the things about Sondheim, I think... there is a tremendous range in terms of subject matters he tries to capture in his musicals. I think he also changes his musical style according to what subject matter he's approaching. The result is that each of the plays are quite different. So you might be less enthusiastic about Sunday in the Park with George and be a huge fan of Company. And actually,
mm-hmm.
I think that's true
mm-hmm.
of a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Sondheim, were you going to say something else?
Well, I was just going to say, it's just No My Fair Lady, you know?
To Know My Fair Lady. There's
you
no,
can't. It's not like something that's going to be done 10 different ways, like Shop Around the Corner. You know? You can't do it. You can't make a You've Got Mail
you know,
out of Sunday in the Park with George.
Yeah.
That's
right.
True.
But people like to say about My Fair Lady is it's the perfect musical. Which doesn't mean it's the best. It doesn't mean it's the most exciting or
well,
whatever.
Can you argue that?
No, but it's the perfect musical and it's self-contained. You can't do anything. You can't improve on it. You can't bend it into a different shape. It is what it is. It's a diamond. And that's that.
But also, it's based on Pygmalion. It's not like it was created on its own.
No, absolutely. It borrows a lot of its dialogue straight from George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion.
And speaking
of
Stephen Sondheim.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Who is apparently working on a new musical adapted from two Luis Buñuel movies with playwright David Ives.
Really?
Who has been working on a revival of, or a presentation of the French play, The Liar. By Pierre Corneille. David Ives, you know, right? Because he wrote Venus and Fur.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, Venus and Fur.
Which was a really good play. A mediocre movie, I thought. The play was great. Let's see, what else has he worked on? Well... That's the most famous one. And so this is a comedy by a great French playwright, 17th century, we think of as a, you know, more of a tragedy writer. And, you know, it might be good. It's being put on by Classic Stage.
Oh, Classic Stage, downtown.
Yeah. Oh, it says he's been working on adapting... various French plays for years, so... anyway, like I said, Venus and Fur was fantastic.
Venus and Fur was fantastic.
So, all right.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I know we still have two more members of the cast of White Christmas to cover, but that'll be another time. Thanks.